The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Divorce and international blight is a special American disease. We lead the world in so many things in America. We lead the world in divorce. We have the dubious distinction of leading the world in crime, in mental illness, and in an almost endless assortment of very glittering and dazzling gadgets with which we like to play. Now, for the rest of you people around the world, wherever you live, you've got your problems, we all have, but your problems aren't quite those of Mr. and Mrs. America in this modern era. We seem to have lost our way. We seem to have lost sight of our personal and our national goals. We've become a nation of people conditioned to failure, and the very basis of all society, the home, in the United States, is falling apart more than any other single country. Our marriages are coming apart at the seams, and for every divorce, there are many other marriages where it's only a sort of a hollow shell of what it used to be, where true happiness is missing, where only a kind of a friendless, casual, day-by-day existence continues. Sort of like two people living in a glamorous hotel, but hardly speaking, and where conversation is all but gone, where all real deep communication is broken down, where nothing is shared anymore, and none of the deep, warm experiences of life come along to really stimulate the marriage. It's no wonder we're getting divorced at a rate that is shameful and higher than ever before. Nearly every fourth home in the United States now, and it's getting close to one out of three. And in Los Angeles County, it's keeping pace with the marriage licenses. For every marriage, there is a divorce. Well, I've been on a series of programs about marriage, about divorce, about dating, about modern courtship, because almost as if with one voice, the counselors, the divorce lawyers, and all of those who deal with the problem will tell you that the thing wrong with American marriage is American courtship, American dating habits and customs, that which leads to marriage. Teenage marriages, hasty marriages, marriages with one partner, shouldn't say that, marriages with the bride, already pregnant. These are becoming more and more commonplace all the time. And the facts prove that the chances for success in such marriages are pretty slim. Now, marriage should be based upon love. And I've said in past programs I wanted to discuss that part of it. Now, we had discussed the first major prerequisite out of seven. I've covered four. About the seven basic keys to a successful marriage, seven primary keys to how to select a mate and how to date. And I talked about physical health and then mental health and then about heredity and environment, or in other words, background and breeding, and then about emotional maturity and stability, personality that is. But now what about this thing of love? You know the old songs you're so used to, what is this thing called love? Well, that's a good question. It's not answered in the song. But people sing about it, they daydream about it, they talk about it, they look wistfully at TV serials, movies, and read novels about it. Most of the time it tells them that love is something which stands your hair straight up and makes your heart go tipsy in you and curls your hair and makes your eyes say tilt. It's a sort of an animal-like desire, as it is expressed in the novels, the movies, and via the various public entertainment media. It's an animal-like desire to have, to get, to take, to grab, to seize, to possess. It's entirely selfish. Love, at least you can put quotations around that word and call it love, the kind of love people talk about falling into, seeks to aggrandize and complement and satisfy the self. And, of course, you see the marriage where the big hulking brute who maybe spends his summers begging bread in the car windows in Yellowstone. But anyhow, here's a big, hulking brute of a character who marries some tiny, little, demure, wallflower-type girl to only further accentuate his own fancied physical stature and his masculinity. And the kind of love that people fall into today is not love at all. It's lust. You see, it's impossible to fall in love. A fall is an accident. And many of these people didn't fall anyhow. They were pushed. Or pulled, as the case may be, but they didn't fall. Now, regardless as to childish whims to the contrary and nursery rhyme daydreams of young teenagers, love is not accidental. It is the result of far deeper considerations than physical attraction and animal fleshly desire. So whatever it is that people are falling into today,
along with open manhole covers and various ditches and other places that people fall into, I'll tell you for one thing for sure, no one has ever, in the history of mankind, now you talk about a shocking statement and crawling out in a twig, we can talk about clarification of terms if you would like, but no one has ever, from the time Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, fallen in love, because that is impossible. Love, as it is defined by any correct definition, and especially the one book which defines love better than any other, which is the book about it, about its origins, about what kind of an emotion it is, about different kinds of love on different planes than most people are familiar with. Love is an outgoing concern. Love is a desire to give, a desire to share, a desire to serve. Love has to do with deep respect. Love has to do with sacrifice. Love is a desire to give of oneself, of one's time, energies, abilities, of one's possessions, of one's own being. Love is a deep concern, an outgoing concern for the one being loved. It's an emotion of the exact opposite nature as that which is called love by most people today. Now, the songs prove it, the novels and movies prove it. What is this thing called love, asks one. Of course, it never answers. And then people answer, well, they just don't know. But, goes another song, they say that falling in love is wonderful. Well, you know, if falling in love is what's happening to these fantastic numbers of people who now are going right back down the aisle in reverse, so to speak, and getting a divorce, then I don't know if it's wonderful or not. Because it breathes a rather fatal finish to this business of so-called falling in love. Now, young people today, dating at age 9, even age 6, age 12, and 14 certainly, age 16 for sure, are told that they should wait around, and maybe in some crowded room they'll gaze across it, and there will be the one that they've been waiting for. The mate that fate had you created for will be standing there, and you will fall into a blinding, dizzying spin, and that old familiar chill will run up and down your back. That old black magic will happen to you. You'll have that blissful feeling that you are falling in love. And you will know, because everything is backwards and upside down, you'll say that you really know you're in love when you wind up the cat and put out the clock, and you just can't even tell which way is north and south. When your heart grows tipsy in you, then you're sure to be under that old spell. And your heart is aflame, and your eyes light up, and your pulse beats fast, and your hair curls. Your heart stops because clang, clang, clang went the trolley, and ding, ding, ding went the bell, and zing, zing, zing went your heartstrings. And whatever it was that happened to you, and whatever your heartstrings are, that's what happened the moment you saw him. You fell. And that's just it. You fell. You had an accident the moment you saw somebody. And that kind of love, that kind of an accident, is infatuation. It's desire, it's lust, it's curiosity, it's excitement, it's physical, animal, fleshly attraction, it's lust, but it's not love. You know, there have been a lot of falls that have been fatal. A lot of people have fallen, some from rather high precipices, and much of the time they don't survive. Now, the one most famous fall was not a fall, but a push. And that's the fall of man. Now, man didn't fall. He just made the wrong choice. And, of course, it's a matter of the choosing of terminology. The being who had to do with confusing mankind and his wife by telling them they ought to switch positions and he ought to follow her had fallen. But then again, he was sort of kicked out himself. But it wasn't an accident, I'll guarantee you. He just made the wrong choice, just like he caused people to make the wrong choice. But a fall can be fatal, so I know that many young people might rebel. What am I saying? Might rebel. But anyway, about the idea of dad and mom having anything whatsoever to do with helping select a mate or helping select who they ought to date and the choosing of their friends and when they ought to get in. But whether we realize it or not, our modern dating customs are very, very new. Now, just because they're new doesn't make them wrong. I know better than that. You know, I know about the little ad where they laughed at Fulton Steamboat and all the rest of it, too. No, just because it's new doesn't make it automatically wrong. Not all new things are wrong, but you know them by their fruits. You know them by the result, by the outcome, by the rewards. What are the fruits of the modern customs of dating? of the large percentages of young people who know each other less than a year and then who get married, or the large percentages of young people who have to get married. What is happening as a result of this modern license and permissiveness, of this unrestrained mixing and pairing off of young people at a fantastically early age in a boy-girl relationship when they hardly know how to analyze the weather, and yet they are assumed by their parents and the church and the school and all society to be perfectly capable of selecting their own friends and future mates. They couldn't tell you very much about geography, about history, about language, music, art, literature, science, mathematics, about social trends, about ethnology, zoology, biology, chemistry, physiology. Their minds, certainly at age 11, 12, and 13, aren't very much chock full of a lot of facts and real knowledge, and certainly they don't have much wisdom or understanding or the ability to put together that knowledge and come to a decision and a course of life involving it. But their parents blithely assume that they're completely capable of selecting people with whom they're going to spend countless hours in sharing deep intimacies which belong in marriage. Fantastic ideas we have today. Well, now, the outcome of some of these fantastic ideas ought to tell us what's wrong with American dating habits just by looking at the rewards, as I said, at the kind of life that is being lived by people. Now, for you young people, if you think that the dating customs are just right the way they are today, well then, can't you prove it by statistics? Doesn't it sound logical that you, therefore, should be able to walk right on out through the lives, into the marriages and the homes of these same young people who follow these their very same dating customs, and be able to demonstrate to the older generation that such dating habits are good because you can prove it? Because there are so many people staying together, because there are so many happy marriages and fine homes, and these young people are succeeding in marriage at a fantastic pace. Well, you can't prove that, can you? For instance, there are 300,000 known, let me emphasize, illegitimate babies being born every year in the United States. But you know what the young people say is that, well, I think that what's moral is what's good or what's acceptable, or it's all right as long as you don't hurt anybody. Now, recently, in a series of articles in a leading newspaper by an educator, morality was seen among high school and college students as a deeply personal thing. And without hesitation, college students were heard to respond when asked, what is really morally right or morally wrong? They said, and I quote, morality is a personal thing. If what you do doesn't hurt someone else, I guess it's all right. End of quotation. Now let's find out if it hurts someone else or not. Because what people are doing does happen to hurt someone else. As I said, the known illegitimate births are 300,000. Every time you hear of 14 babies born, one of them was illegitimate. Among non-whites in the United States, it's 1 out of 4, 25%. However, nearly half of all illegitimate babies are born to girls between the ages of 15 and 19. Now, whether or not those girls are hurt, well, I think I gave you the statistics about these young unmarried mothers who were studied, and how about 90 of them had gone on to have as many as 5 illegitimate children and had never come to a place in life where they'd experienced any real happiness. Their lives were a shambles, an empty, wretched, hollow shell. Now, Dr. Enrique Leon Mata, Jr., who is director of the Maternal and Child Health Division of the Dade County Department of Public Health in Florida, said pregnancy is the number one health problem among the teenage group. And he ranked venereal disease as health problem number 2. And he said the big factor in this is just simply going steady, and the easy accessibility to the use of the family automobile. Now, the U.S. News and World Report said recently sociologists are at a loss to explain the sharp and persistent rise in illegitimate births since 1943. Well, why should they be? When you look at our growing affluence, you look at the watering down of our moral standards, you look at the increasing violence and the sexual permissiveness and licentiousness portrayed on the silver screen, in TV, and the novels, the tremendous avalanche, the tidal wave, the filthy, racy pool of pornography that is scattered all over the country. Why should they be at a loss to explain the sharp and persistent rise in illegitimate births? It all is tied in together. Now, of 100 teenage Dunwet mothers who were studied in Connecticut from their birth pregnancies, as I said, 95 of them continued to have up to 5 illegitimate children each, and only 9 out of that group were married, and 60 of them were living on welfare. So listen, teenagers, you can kiss yourself all day long, but you're not going to change the facts. Now, the facts, you know, that people are faced with concerning lung cancer are facts. But a lot of smokers like to kid themselves. So a lot of people, of course, look at it objectively, and they're faithless, and they say, well, at least I acknowledge what the statistics are, and I'm willing to take my chance. I realize I have one chance out of so many if I smoke 2 packs a day. I have one chance out of so many if I smoke 1 pack a day, and I've got a better chance if I switch to a pipe, and of course, I've got the best chance of all if I just quit smoking. You find teenagers in dating and courtship aren't quite so willing to even look at it objectively. But here are the facts and the statistics. At least you ought to be honest enough to realize that here are the representative segments of teenage and young adult society today, and here are the factors about health, about mental illness, about psychoses, about the watering down of morals, about the growing resentment and disrespect toward law enforcement agencies and law in general. These are the facts, and then when you think about falling in love, and when you think about dating or going steady, you ought to think about it with both eyes wide open. Not with a pink, fluffy cloud of boyhood or girlhood nursery rhyme dreams and a lot of head-shaking, foot-tapping music that kind of dramatizes the infatuation that people like to call love. You ought to think about it with both eyes wide open and not kid yourself at all. Now, the American Medical Association reports that every day 1,500 United States teenagers and young adults are infected with syphilis, gonorrhea, or both. That's fact. In 1961, the United States Surgeon General formed a task force of experts to study the VD plague in the United States, and since then, yearly infections have tripled, and in some large city areas, they are up 800%. Now, look at this one. Every year, there is a vast army of young people of 1,700,000 strong who contract VD. In the United States alone. That's new cases. 1,700,000 per year. And an increasing percentage of VD, especially among youths, is caused by homosexual contact, and in some cases, only after slight symptoms, the syphilis virus can lie dormant to hit again. In 5 to 20 years, attacking heart, eyes, brain, or nervous system, often even killing, and causing a fantastic array of congenital deformities, blindness, and what have you. And VD is not confined to any social or status group. It's climbing remarkably in all social and status groups in the country today. Well, it's about time you look at it, isn't it? Now, on the other side of the coin, when you see all these statistics about divorce, about teenage marriages falling apart, about illegitimacy and venereal disease, then you listen to what some of the young teens are saying about morality, about their concepts of God and religion and truth and morality and ethics and standards of conduct, and you see why the illegitimacy and why the increasing venereal disease and why the marriages don't last. Are moral standards really necessary, a college student wonders? He says, I'm taking a course from a professor who asks many disturbing questions. He tells us to forget our ethical and moral standards. Does he really mean that? How can I refute his statement? Well, upon what are his statements based? If his statements are based upon his own ideas, then you can refute them with your own ideas, because they're just his opinions. No one can prove a dumb, hideous statement like that, that there aren't any such things as moral standards. Only a boob would say something of that nature. Only the fool would say in his heart that there is no God, and there are no laws, and there are no moral standards, and that they aren't necessary. He knows they're necessary living next door to his neighbor. He knows they're necessary to protect his life, limb, and property. He knows they're necessary to keep the world free from ravages of nuclear war by despots, anarchists, madmen in seats of power who might trigger a nuclear bomb war to rule over nothing but desolation. Anybody that tells you there aren't any such things as moral standards must be a little bit out of touch with reality. A group of teenagers on a panel were asked, what holds you back from immoral conduct? Or, for that matter, does anything? Here were their answers. Now, remembering these statistics on illegitimacy and venereal disease, one teen said, that's a good question. That's all he had to say. Another one said, I couldn't say. Another one said, the idea of God and concepts of religion don't tend to be real things. They aren't something you can look at face to face. They're just kind of nebulous. Oh, they are? Well, how come? What do you mean, nebulous? He didn't know what he meant. Neither do you, probably. Concepts of God. Well, people's concepts, I suppose that would be true. They're kind of nebulous because a lot of people have a lot of nebulous concepts. But what about getting to the source? What about asking yourself a few simple questions? Is it possible to prove scientifically the existence of a creator? Let's put it another way. Is it possible to prove scientifically that creation exists? Oh, sure. You can prove there is matter, can't you? You can prove there are energies and laws and forces. You can prove the world exists, can't you? Well, now, next step, can you prove it came into existence without a creator? Can you prove laws without a lawgiver? What about the refraction of light rays, the cleavage properties of minerals? What about all of the laws and forces and energies that work upon our environment? You ever thought to prove it? There's an inventor of marriage. Now, the people that go up before the priest or the JP or the minister or what have you to be married are asking, apparently, God to do it. Even in pagan tribal societies, they claim to ask some kind of a supreme being, a superior being, to bind them together in these various customs. They're going to ask God to do it. A lot of brides will carry a little white Bible. I don't know if they've read it, but carry it. And they sometimes even have a lily on it. And they walk down the aisle. And they're clutching this Bible. And the minister says some strange-sounding words about God marrying them or something to this effect. They're kind of dizzy and they don't really hear a word he says, and they're thinking about skipping out and jumping in a car and rushing off somewhere, but at least society ostensibly claims to believe that there is some kind of a being in heaven above who marries people. And young people are asking a God to marry them. Yet when they come up with questions about morality, about law, about mores, about principles, about standards for conduct and ethics, they say, well, I don't know about that. I don't know if you can know any absolute truth. It's kind of nebulous. Well, that's because you yourself have never come to grips with the basic questions and never demanded a satisfactory answer. You've never asked, what are you? Why are you on this earth? Where did you come from? How did life begin? Is there a purpose in human life? Is there a goal you ought to be achieving? Is there some direction your life ought to take? What is the ultimate destiny of mankind? We like to avoid these questions. We like to deal with higher salaries and infatuation and maybe the war in Vietnam. Well, these teenagers said, well, the biggest problem is, how can you know absolute truth? Now, listen, parents and educators, you like to blame the kids for their rebellion, huh? You like to say, yes, these teenagers are out and getting in all kinds of illegitimacy and venereal disease. Oh, sure, we like to say the teens are guilty. Well, all these youngsters are doing is parroting exactly what their elders have told them. Here are teenagers, 15, 17, and 18, saying, well, you can't know any absolute truth. Balderdash. You can know millions of facts, and you can know absolute and positive truth. But all they're doing is parroting something that some professor told them, and he doesn't know anything of the kind. Now, who is really guilty for all of this kind of prating around about no absolute truth, and God is dead, and you can't know whether something works or not? I'll tell you. When your marriage blows up in your face, when people are screaming they hate each other, maybe snatching up a gun or a knife, as many people do, and remember that the preponderant proportion of homicide in the United States happens between husbands and wives, then you can tell that this couple, this family, has not been put together upon any laws that would make that family or that marriage work. That there are broken laws behind it, that they have violated every basic precept that would put their marriage together and hold it together. We're not ignorant. We're not out of touch with cause and effect. There is a cause for all this marital unhappiness. There is a cause for illegitimacy, for venereal disease, for divorce, and broken homes, and the resultant crime and violence and juvenile delinquency that it causes directly attributable to much of the juvenile delinquency is broken homes. That's a fact. Now these boys say, one young fellow said, well, you have to keep coming back to the fact that we don't know absolute law. Now, he didn't know that, but his professor told him that. Another one said, there aren't any specific standards, like on the first date, you can only hold hands, or on the second or fifth date, or whatever date it is that you can kiss him. You set the standards for yourself. You kind of play it by the ear at the moment, said another girl. Oh, you do? Who told her that? Oh, other kids? Maybe some professor? You know, another one said, I am sure I know and see quite a few people of our age who are very immoral by my standards, but he said, who's to judge what is right and wrong? I believe there is an absolute truth, but I'm not saying I know it. So listen, educators, teachers, preachers, lawyers, parents, because all these kids are doing is parroting what you've been telling them, and somebody's been telling them a lot of hideous distortions and untruths. Now, who? Well, of course, we have to look into that, don't we? But whoever ever told you that there is no such thing as absolute truth didn't know what he was talking about. And you ought to investigate his background, find out what he really believes and what his personal conduct is like. Because there are laws, there are absolute truths upon which marriage ought to be based. There are definite, workable, practical keys that will guarantee you can have a happy marriage. I've been covering them in a series of programs. I'm going to wrap them up here in a couple, three more programs now, so be sure to listen to every one of them. But I wanted to cover this thing about love versus lust briefly in this one and show you how most people are looking only at physical, sensual attraction. And what can aggrandize themselves? What can appeal to their own private vanity? Not who can they serve? Not thinking about outgoing concerns, not thinking about sharing, about giving, but only about taking and getting. And all of our songs and our novels and our romances that we portray in the silver screen prove that statement to be true. You need to write in for these articles on how to have a happy marriage and how to solve family arguments. Because they work, they're practical, and they're really up to date, and you can apply them and you'll get results. Now, in the meantime, write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, the January number, with this article on Inside Communist Romania, an article written from Dusseldorf, Germany. Where is Germany headed now with this grand coalition that's occurred and all the statements hurled back and forth in the press about Nazis behind the scenes in Germany? What's behind that? Where is Germany headed now? Here's another article on the spot with de Gaulle in the South Pacific. Another article, how you can be happy. People say Happy New Year, but that's sort of a hollow sound this year, isn't it? Here's an article that shows you how to be truly happy. And also these articles on how to have a happy marriage and how to solve family arguments. It's free of charge, no price, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station, the address again in just a moment. Until next time in the same series of programs, and I'll wrap it up in the next two or three, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, hey friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.